This is the I Read Comic Books podcast, a function of Destroy the Cyborg. I'm Nick White, and this week I'm joined by Jonathan Francois, who is an editor and contributor to video games, and Paul Jaisley, who is also an editor and contributor, but for comic books. It's great to have you two with me this week.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to be here.
It's always a good week when we got these two around, and when Mike is gone, and you know that he's somewhere out there sweating it, hoping that we don't ruin the podcast or spoil a TV show or just generally dismantle all of the things he has worked so hard to achieve in his life, like this podcast.
Let's get started.
Yeah.
So let's crack into that. What did you guys read this week? Was there good stuff, bad stuff, just strictly middling stuff?
Just
did you get into
stuff.
Any digital stuff? Or what about you, Paul?
Well, I had a combination of a very small pull list and a very busy work week, so I didn't read a whole lot. But what I did manage to squeeze in, I enjoyed quite a bit. Batman number 46. I think I've raved about this book enough on this podcast. You know why I enjoy it, why I'm enjoying Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo's take on the character so much right now. I have to say, I'm very surprised that they're keeping this status quo going this long. As a jaded and longtime comic book reader, I know that issue 50 is around the corner. So, you know, something's going to give. Bruce Wayne's going to come back and be Batman again. But I'm enjoying the ride up until then. I'm assuming that's going to happen in issue 50. I have no reason, other than just my history and knowledge of how comic books work, that that's going to be the case. But as for now, I'm still really enjoying that series quite a bit. Twilight Children number 2, again, I think I raved about the first issue of this series a couple weeks ago. Second issue was just as good, although I'm curious why they're doing it as a four-part miniseries and not just a collected original graphic novel. It'll read, I think, good either way. And then finally, I continued reading Preacher. I squeezed in issues 13 through 17 of the Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon modern classic. I don't know if this book has aged that well, or if you read it when you were a teenager in the 90s, it was a little more engaging, but still interesting story. I'm very curious to see how it's going to be translated to TV when it is eventually, but that's about all I managed to read this week. What about you, John?
Well, mine is actually pretty short as well. The only book that I've read this week so far has been the new Rat Queens, number 13, and I have waited a figurative lifetime for this to happen. It seems like this book is they've taken a few breaks between issues, and I'm still enjoying it. It's different from the first arc, so I was a little put off by that, but I'm still enjoying the overall feel and theme of the book itself. I actually just read that today. It definitely wasn't right before we started, so I could have something to talk about, though.
That's good. That's good. The fact that you brought it up in that fashion really makes me believe you 100%. Do you like the new art on that, John? Or where do you rank the art relative to the other two?
Well, so gosh, I like the art, and if it had started out with that art, I think it would have been fine.
Okay.
But the problem is that I really, really enjoyed the first art. I forget the artist's name now.
Rock Upchurch,
that's the one, yeah. His art really encapsulated what I enjoyed about... It's basically the way the theme and the art went together. I thought was very, very good. And so when you compare it, or at least when I compare it to the new art styles, they seem slightly lacking. They're not bad, and if they had started off in either of the other two art styles, I would have been more than happy with it, but it feels to me like a sort of a step down, albeit a small one.
Huh. That's really, really interesting, because Mike, on last week's podcast, which you undoubtedly already listened to, so I'm just repeating this, but Mike actually, I think, prefers the new art. I think in a lot of ways he says it has more of a classical fantasy D&D look, as opposed to the sort of the modern newish look of Upchurch. But I mean, it's not like it's going to keep you from reading this book, right? This isn't like
yeah, no. I'm the art itself will not keep me from reading the book unless they did something, you know, really drastic.
Okay, that's fair. Well, I managed to get around to some reading this week. It's a really weird, odd hodgepodge. Usually half of my reading are random things I found, and the other half are things that I desperately feel I need to catch up on. So I read Dr. Fate number 3, despite the fact that I think number 6 comes out this week. So you can tell how far behind I am there. It's a beautiful book, beautiful book. Sonny Liu's artwork is unlike anything else. I just don't know if it was well paired with Paul Levitz on writing. I also read Ivar Timewalker 10, which, honestly, one of the more beautiful issues of the series, but really it was just a weird novelty of, hey, what if in Roman times it was dinosaurs instead of people, and now you have dinosaurs wearing togas and wearing traditional armor, and isn't that funny? And it was funny, but not for like not 30 pages. I think probably the biggest, most interesting read that I really enjoyed was I tried Legendary Comics Pacific Rim Tales from the Drift. You have a fantastic team on this. You got Joshua Hale Fiekalov on writing, and you have, I think his name is Marco Mars on pencils. And you've got Marcelo Maiolo on art. So you effectively have two-thirds of the iVampire team, which that's a winning combination any day of the week. Chronologically, it's a weird book because I thought they said it was technically supposed to take place after the movie, but the issue is very carefully written in a way that makes it very difficult to pinpoint if it follows or precedes the events of the film. But either way, it's beautiful, and it's definitely, it's not like, oh, monster of the week, let's fight and kill this thing. It's very much very dark and driven by the idea that not everybody is going to make it out of this thing okay, and some of these giant Jaegers are gonna meet an untimely and unpleasant demise where people get like radiation poisoning, and I guess that's why I like it. Have either of you heard about this book, or have both No. of you seen Pacific Rim, or am I preaching to an empty crowd here?
I've seen the movie, but I hadn't heard of this book before.
No, me neither.
Okay.
But it does sound cool. I think I'd like to seek it out and try to read it now, because that sounds right up my alley.
Yeah, kaiju and Jaegers duking it out, and you really can't get much better than that. Other than that, I managed to nab a Humble Bundle with really old X-Files comics, so...
How old were they, Nick?
How old were they? We are talking like 95, 96, but here's an interesting little tidbit of knowledge for you. The penciler on, I think, the first 40 issues is actually the ongoing penciler of The Walking Dead.
Oh, interesting. Currently. Huh.
Yeah, he drew about 40 issues of X-Files back for Topps Comics, back when Topps decided that they were going to get into the comics book game as well, uh-huh. Right before everything blew up.
Right.
So, what better place to wrap up our picks than on the comic book implosion of the 90s? We'll give you a few seconds to look that up or dwell upon the unfortunate fate that followed that, and we'll be back in a bit with our weekly picks. Well, what kind of podcast would this be if we didn't do weekly picks? So we're just going to start that right now and keep this ongoing tradition alive. Yay! Feigned enthusiasm. Really, it's not feigned like I'm not excited. I am. I'm just not capable of expressing joy. Paul, what was your weekly pick for the upcoming week?
Well, this was a tough week to pick one. I have to be honest. There's a lot of stuff coming out this week. Obviously, there's a new Dark Knight Returns book coming out. I don't know if you heard about that. That's this week. So, but it's not my pick, shockingly enough, as excited as I am about that book. The only thing that could get me more excited than a new Batman comic by Frank Miller is, of course, professional wrestling. And my pick this week is Ringside Number 1, which is a comic book all about professional wrestling. So this is by Joe Keating, who writes Shudder. Okay. I'm not super familiar with a lot of his stuff, so he's kind of a new writer for me. And the artist on this is a guy named Nick Barber, who I think Joe Keating, as far as I can tell, sort of quote-unquote discovered him. He had a Tumblr that Joe Keating saw and then pitched this book. So it's kind of his first comic book that he's doing. So all new all around for me, more or less. And this book apparently is going to be focusing on the action outside the ring, hence the name Ringside. So it's back in the locker rooms, the sort of cutthroat, carny tradition that pro wrestling still has today, outside and outside the ring and backstage. So sounds right up my alley, obviously, because the only thing I like more than comic books is professional wrestling. So combine the two, that's a perfect book for me, it sounds like.
That sounds like a winner. Joe Keating, if I remember correctly, he absolutely killed it with a book you might remember called Hell Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I don't think I read that, but I remember seeing that on the shelf and flipping through it, so that was him. And then he's writing Shudder as well, which is one that I, again, keep picking up off the shelf, flipping through, but never actually buying, so we'll see how this goes for me. I might have to jump onto his other stuff.
Now, when you say, like, behind the scenes, do you mean, like, I know that wrestling, like, part of the wrestling shows are that you have the stuff that happens off to the side or off the set or where people, like, all these, I mean, these are still scripted sequences, but they're out of the ring. Or do you literally mean outside of that as well? And you're just saying when there's no camera on you and there's nobody publicizing things or...
It sounds like the focus is going to be the reality, you know, the business itself, not anything on camera. Obviously, there will be wrestling sequences, I imagine, but the focus Joe Keating seems to be implying is going to be this sort of backstage, literally backstage, behind the camera, nuts and bolts business aspect, which is really fascinating, I think, because professional wrestling is something that for decades shielded that. You know what I mean? That wasn't part of its on camera presentation. In the past you know, two decades, that's changed, and they've incorporated that. So we know it's fiction. You know, they broke kayfabe. More or less. So,
but you might have to explain what that is for some of our listeners.
Kayfabe is the actual on-camera, on-TV story. That's what you're watching. That's kayfabe, which is basically carny speak for be fake. And then the actual nuts and bolts business stuff, that's what this book is focusing on. The actual lives of the wrestlers themselves, the business, booking the show, putting the matches on, the reality, as opposed to the quote-unquote reality of kayfabe. So I've always found that stuff really fascinating because there is still a carny, traveling carnival, you know, aspect to that even today in professional wrestling. It's a little more cutthroat than a lot of more professional elements of the business are. So
sure, absolutely. Yeah. Now, is it a more of a modern setting or is it like early days of wrestling, you know, decades and decades back?
Well, I haven't read the book yet, but based on what I've read, it seems to be like the modern televised product.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay.
I was going to say, did I sell you on it, Nick? Are you going to pick it up?
It definitely sounds interesting. I admit I would probably be more inclined to pick up a wrestling comic where I'm not entering into the WWE or something like that, where I'm just going to be constantly nervous about, okay, I've heard of this guy before, but what's the relevancy? And then I fall down the rabbit hole of Wikipedia.
Right.
So if it's surrounding like all new fictionalized characters, yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
And anything that goes behind the scenes of anything is usually fascinating. So
yeah.
I'll have to take a look at the art. And then, that's definitely something I might consider.
Cool.
What about you, John? What's your pick for this week? I think we're going here from a brand new book to an established modern classic. Indeed. I wrong, John?
Yes. No, you're not wrong. My pick for the week is Saga number 31.
Wow, we're at 31 already.
Jeez. We are. Yeah, they just they just got off of one of those 2-month off breaks. Start of a new arc. And I'm sure I'll find out what the quote-unquote theme of the arc is when I pick it up next week and then read it in the car and try not to cry on the way home.
I hope you're not like reading it in the car and crying and driving at the same time, because this sounds
I'll wait till a stoplight.
don't read Saga and drive. Don't read Saga and drive. Got it. Now tell me, what's your general feeling towards Saga right now? Because most of the people I meet are starting to reach a point with this book, and, you know, it's at 31. Read into that whatever you will. I know some people have actually weighed dropping it, a few have actually gone through with it, and some people are feeling There you go. There's one right there. There's Paul dropped it. Are you feeling any burnout? Not to you know, put you in a position where you've got to, you know, endorse this, but are you feeling burned out? Do you feel like it's creatively exhausted, or are you feeling something completely opposite to that?
No, I've reached. I guess I would call it a sort of comfortable relationship with Saga, where we've passed like the romance of "look at me, I'm a new book," and now like I'll wake up in the middle of the night next to Saga, and it'll roll over and fart, and I'll smile because it humanizes the book. So I'm happy with where it is, and I don't know. I like this story, and I'm invested to see where it goes, because there are still some unresolved aspects that they set in motion, you know, two or three arcs ago that we're going to see, I'm hoping going to see come to fruition sometime soon. So it's not really lost its charm for me. There was a moment when I had contemplated dropping it, and then they brought it back into a place or an area where I was like, yeah, no, I like this. That's much better than what I thought was going to happen. And ever since then, I've sort of been like, well, I shouldn't doubt this. They'll have my back. And until they do something to betray me again, I will probably just keep buying it out of loyalty, or just because I enjoy the story.
Sure. Yeah, that's totally understandable. Yeah. Paul, do you think you would switch this over to trade at some point, or are you pretty much off this train altogether?
You know, it's tough. I think we're going to talk about this later in the episode, this very idea of what keeps us on a book and, you know, what doesn't. I know for me personally, I just reached a point where every issue was very well made. It's a beautiful looking book. I think Brian K. Vaughan is a very good writer. It's a very good comic book, but I just found myself not emotionally engaged at all with the characters. I reached a point where I just didn't really care what happened to them at all. And I decided, well, if that's the case, then why am I reading it? I mean, I can just see pretty art anytime I want. There's other Brian K. Vaughan books I can read. Unless I hear otherwise, I'm pretty much done. You know, if I hear good reviews for this new arc, I might check it out again in singles, because that's just the way I read things. But yeah, I just reached a point where I was like, wait, it's no longer a story for me. Even though I admit it's a very, very well-made and good comic book, just not for me. And that's kind of, it was kind of hard to admit that, but here I am in a safe space where I could admit that, so.
Sure. Yeah. Well, for me, I went ahead and after just disparaging Ivar Timewalker number 10, which is the only comic book I read that consistently has a comma in its title, so I guess I should call it Ivar Timewalker. Again, I don't know why they have that there, but that aside, my pick for this week is Ivar Timewalker 11. As I briefly mentioned last month, we had them traveling to an alternate history where all of the Romans were actually dinosaurs, and that issue was kind of a little bit of a one-trick pony, but I'm interested to see what they do with 11, because 10 reminded us of this really awful villain we had all the way back towards the beginning of, I think, like Archer and Armstrong 6, where these guys called the Void, and they're basically trying to bring about the end of the world. I don't remember exactly how it all works out, but in some weird mathematical calculation, entropy sort of thing, they figure that will bring balance to everything. So they're basically just your average villain who sees justice or validation in the ending of the universe altogether. So they are attempting to, if I remember this right, they're trying to drag a meteor out of space and have it like bring about the Earth's extinction, and so of course Ivar is going to try to prevent that, and at the same time we're going to figure out what's going on with these other two clones of the same. Anyway, nobody else reads Ivar Timewalker. I'm interested to see where it goes, so at least that has some interest for me. And I'll get back to you once I have something about that book that might make sense to the average audience. Yay, go read this book. But I will. So that being said, now that we've discussed the idea of what keeps you reading an ongoing series just a little bit, we'll be back in a few seconds here, and we'll go into a more in-depth discussion on said topic. this week's main discussion topic, we're going to go over the issue of what keeps you reading an ongoing. Now, for those of our listeners who don't know, an ongoing book is one that is not a miniseries, a one-shot, an annual, or anything else of the like. An ongoing book will continue to go on for seemingly as long as the sales permit its existence, or unless some weird order from up above says this book's got to end. So a good example would be Batman. Batman's been a series that's gone on forever. Detective Comics, same thing. Action Comics, same thing. Amazing Spider-Man, exactly the same thing. And take that, people who say I know nothing about Marvel, because I just listed
one book.
One book. So stick that in your pipe and smoke it. Whichever Marvel character smokes. I would insert a name there, but I don't know enough to know a Marvel character that smokes. So, that minor digression aside, what keeps you guys reading an ongoing series? What motivates you to continue reading? What sort of changes or different features really encourage you to keep at that book 50, 60, 70 issues down the line, or in the case of Invincible, crack it into three digits?
Aside from just habit, which is obviously probably the biggest thing that keeps me reading an ongoing series. It's got to be, for me personally, I think it really is characters. Having a connection and emotional investment in the characters is what really keeps me coming back to books like Batman. I read Batman as a kid. I still like Batman as an adult. I have an affinity and a connection to that character and the peripheral characters. I love the big casts of books like that, where you have a bunch of, you know, side characters and side stories going on. Something like Love and Rockets, I keep buying and reading because of the characters, because I have an emotional investment in the story and their fictional lives. So that's what I think keeps me coming back to certain titles and certain books, staying on them because I have a connection to the story and the characters themselves. That makes it very hard to say goodbye. You know, as Boys to Men once said, it's so hard to say goodbye in some cases like that.
Well, Paul, I think that reference predates me by about maybe 2 or 3 years, but I'll take your word.
I don't know where that came from. I apologize. So.
No, please. It sounded like something I'd definitely roll out. So I'm not about to condemn that sort of offhand reference. We encourage all. Okay. Music references, don't go wild, but, you know, a few here and there, just no Guns N' Roses. We have a very strict no Guns N' Roses policy.
Okay.
There will be no utterances regarding Top Hats or Welcome to the Jungle. Just not okay.
Noted.
Not okay.
Not after the incident 3 months ago.
Yeah, you're right. This is not an unfounded policy. This is in place for your protection. End of story. That being said, or not that being said, because this is a real rough transition that I'm not even going to hide, is there. Paul, it's interesting that you talk about characters in terms of keeping you reading and ongoing, and you listed off Batman, which of course I read as well. But what I find sort of interesting about Batman is that undoubtedly, with having so many different writers, with having so many different artists, and certainly having so many different editorial policies and people up top in terms of DC, obviously, the character of Batman has changed a great deal, his personality, as well as Bruce Wayne's personality. And so what do you think keeps you, and certainly quite a few other Batman readers out there, continuing to read a book where Batman continues to be the main character, or at least most of the time, but the character of Batman has undoubtedly changed? Don't you think, or why do you think that has not caused people to jump ship? Or am I totally wrong and they have?
Okay, so a couple points here.
I realized that was about 90 questions. Yeah, I apologize.
No, I have a few points here, and hopefully they connect into a coherent discussion. I mentioned a book like Love and Rockets. Now, Love and Rockets arguably is my favorite comic book of all time. There are a few contenders, but that's in the top three for me. And the reason I like it is because it's one continuous story. The main character, Maggie, she is introduced as a 15-year-old in the first story. She's now in her mid-40s. It's the same character. She's aged in real time. She hasn't changed, aside from aging, you know, it's the same character. It hasn't been rebooted or anything. Batman is the exact opposite, where every, you know, generation has their different take on the character. Every writer tries to do a different spin on the character. And I think I like that because it keeps that character fresh. Batman's been around for 76 years now. You can't keep telling the same types of stories. So it's not so much I think the character is radically changing. It's just he's looked at through a different lens, so to speak, by different writers and different creative teams. And that's fun to see. On top of that, the point I want to make is that certain takes on that character work better for me. I love reading Batman comics, but I don't read all of them. I'm only reading the main title, Batman, and a couple peripheral titles like Gotham Academy. And I think that might be it, actually. But I'm not reading Detective Comics or you know, so a few of the other ones just because the creative teams don't work for me. I'm not particularly engaged with that take on the character. So in a character like that I have a connection to, if there's multiple takes, yeah, I'm going to pick the one that kind of works better for me and kind of ignore the other ones, so to speak.
Sure, absolutely. What about you, John? Is there any sort of big issue or deal breaker for you that keeps you reading an ongoing series, or is there some common characteristic amidst all of these books that you read a lot of that you keeps you reading them? For example, you mentioned you're on Saga 31 rolling out this week. Do you feel that there's something with the series that just continues to roll on that has kept you coming back? Is there something you can distill from that book that you think is what's the motivating force?
So, for the most part, I think that the biggest thing that I enjoy in a series is the idea of permanency. In Marvel, you know, someone will die, but that is, for the most part, meaningless if they come back later on, and you sort of can expect that they'll come back later on when Marvel feels that they need to make a little more money. But in Saga, they, you know, when someone dies, that's it, they're dead, and it happens with enough frequency that it's an impactful moment, and you think, oh, hey, you know, this character is neat, I enjoy what's happening with them, and they're dead. And so you have just no time to get attached to them, and then you feel this other, like, anguish of, oh no, they died. And sometimes it's for a good cause, and sometimes just it sucks you in the wrong place. And that sort of added to the realism of it is just not everyone dies for a heroic reason. Sometimes that person is just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think that for the most part, that is the common factor amongst all of the books that I read, or a lot of them anyways. The other main driving factor is humor. For example, The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl is a favorite of mine, and that obviously does not have wanton murder in it. It's just lighthearted and funny.
Okay. Interesting. It's rare to find. It's interesting that you bring up humor books, because I think it's very rare to find ongoing series around which the topic of humor is like the focal point. It certainly doesn't seem like humor books go on for long periods of time. It's almost always drama, right? It seems like it plays out that way. So when you find a book that's actually humor oriented and it's, you know, going on forever, I think sometimes they worry about how they're gonna, but then again, you know, The Simpsons is on issue like 270, so don't worry, I'll just contradict myself before anyone else gets a chance. Paul, you were going to say.
No, actually, I had no point there. So.
No, that was me drawing in breath, actually, not
yeah.
Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I was going to agree with you, actually, that I think that also a lot of humor books tend to peter off, and I've braced myself for the what I feel is the inevitable decline of this book at some point when they just begin to run out of funny things that Squirrel Girl can do without rehashing something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that sort of is the concern with the when you have an ongoing series at a big two book that doesn't seem to play well with you know, the themes of tie-ins and events and things like that. You're always, you know, trying to keep your finger on the pulse of whether or not the big two is going to be like, you know what, this book, it's a little too weird. Better destroy it. Yeah.
I can't tie this in to Secret Infinity and charge someone $6 for it.
Right, exactly. How does this have to do with Battleworld? Well, it doesn't. It has nothing to do with Battleworld. It's not going to have anything to do with that. Well, then why do we have it? So,
you know, the interesting point there you made, Nick, about drama or serious books being lend themselves more to ongoing, you know, series.
Yeah.
And It's really fascinating because I think that speaks to the point I was trying to make, that it's an emotional engagement with the characters that keeps me coming back. And in the case of Saga, like I mentioned earlier, I kind of lost that connection. Despite the fact the book is beautifully made, very well written, I like the characters in it, but I reached a point where it didn't really matter to me what happened to them. And that's the point where the book kind of lost me as a reader. And being able to sort of look beyond that and try to think what would draw me back to the book, or look beyond that and think what would draw me back to the book, or is there something else in a comic that could keep me engaged rather than just an emotional investment with the characters? I don't know.
Absolutely.
You know, what do you guys think about that? Is there something that draws you to a book besides just, hey, I like these characters, or I like this, you know, the humor of it or the style of it?
Setting is a big thing for me. The Autumn Lands, Tooth and Claw, is about magic animals, and then suddenly there's a human, and I'm not going to go too much.
That's just John's favorite genre. Like, whenever he goes into Barnes & Noble, he goes for the section labeled magic animals, .. but there's a human.
That's it. You know what? I own like a dozen different books in that theme. You're right. I didn't want to go too far because it's been out for a while, but I didn't want to just drop spoilers without having some sort of warning. But it's a neat setting where it's very high fantasy. Everything is powered by magic. They have, you know, these giant floating, flying cities, and everyone is a wizard, except for the guys who aren't, and they're kind of like slaves, but they don't have magic.
All I could think of when you
do?
Said that was baby cakes, I'm sorry. Have you seen that skit where he goes to the opera
yes,
with his
I
dad?
Have. Yes.
He's like, everyone was a wizard. Everyone was secretly a wizard. Sorry. Thank God you at least know what I'm talking about.
I appreciated that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, you're fine.
No, that book is amazing.
Are you reading it too?
I'm reading it in trade, which I guess technically I think means I'm only one issue behind, because I think they're on 7.
And yeah, I think
arc
so.
Arc 1 goes through 6. But yeah, so you're saying just the basic idea of a certain genre or a certain setting, especially those that are harder to find, like that keeps you reading sometimes even if the other things drop off, just having a very unique setting or a very unique set of circumstances that you probably think you aren't going to see in any other book for, you know, who knows how long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it gives it more of a buffer to prevent me from dropping
absolutely.
It. It's probably a better way of saying it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I definitely hear you there. Paul, something you brought up earlier kind of made me think. We were talking about the difference between an ongoing book at Image and the difference sort of, I think this is kind of what you're getting at, the difference between an ongoing Image book and the difference between an ongoing New 52 or I guess technically it's not that, an ongoing
DCU.
Big 2 book. Let's just say that.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, and we were looking at this, is that seemingly it sounds like a non-Big 2 book that's ongoing is quote-unquote better sometimes. But when you think about it, with an ongoing, like an Image book, for example, if you don't like an ongoing Image book, that team is probably not going to change ever due to the contract issues and whatnot that an Image book has.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about that. Like, if you don't like where an Image book is now, you're probably not, if it's a, you know, if it's a team thing that's bothering you, that's almost never going to change for you.
That's an interesting point, because when I came back to reading comics again about 7 or 8 years ago, I went from being a kid who just read books because of the characters and a person that read books because of the creative team, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And that's a big draw, even though obviously there's characters that I'm always going to want to check out, like Batman. I wish there was a Spider-Man book I liked right now because I love Spider-Man. But unless there's a creative team on a book, Spider-Man book that I like, I'm not going to pick one up. But Image is an interesting example because that the books are linked to that creative team. You know, they're not. The Walking Dead is never going to have a different creative team. There's not going to be a different writer take over that book, I'm assuming, right?
know, unless Kirkman just gets that much busier.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's what keeps people reading those books, is an attraction to the creative team and the characters. So I might drop Saga just because the book's not working for me, but I know that I can go pick up Paper Girls by Brian K. Vaughan and still get, you know, his writing that I like. Or I could read Archie and have Fiona Staples' art that I like. So following creative teams makes it somewhat easier to pick and choose what I'm reading, as opposed to sticking with a franchise or a character that I feel obligated to keep reading. I feel like I'm going to have to always be reading at least one Batman book.
Yeah.
Regardless of who's writing or drawing it. It's just something I'm attracted to. But those Image series, there's a handful that are ongoing, and it's because of the creative team's commitment to the character and the reader's commitment to that creative team, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably one of my only issues with Image, is that with my DC books, if I don't like who's writing it or if I don't like who's drawing it, there's a very good chance that within 10 issues or so, there's a chance there might actually be some change, assuming that there are other people who are in the same boat as me. When the Arrow team took over, when the Arrow team TV show took over Green Arrow comic book, following the Lemire run, I was not happy because, and I'm sure I've voiced this probably about 18 times by now, I was like, well, this is another example of TV thinking it knows, you know, how to sell comic books, and it's gonna dilute my canon, and these things should be separate. Although now it sounds like I'm trying to say these things should be separate but equal. Don't edit that out and make it sound awful, Xander. But I stuck around because I said, you know what, there's no way that all of the hard work that, you know, Jeff Lemire, as I've now been told, there's no way that all of his hard work is going to be dismantled so quickly by these writers, except I was wrong. But that just goes to show you, sometimes even someone can set up a universe and you keep reading because you hope that even if the teams change, all of their hard work will not be for naught.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you're wrong. But that was an interesting experience. And then I sort of stuck it out and went through that arc of Green Arrow, which I didn't really like. But sure enough, after about 7 issues, those guys were gone. And I think what's weird is when I was a younger reader, if you would have said, hey, you know, wouldn't it be cool if when this arc is over, you get a new writer, but you'll probably get a new artist. And I think a lot of the time I would have been like, well, why the heck would I like that? Like, even especially if I think the artist is doing a good job, I think when I was a younger reader, I would have said, dude, if, and I would have said dude back then, maybe not, you know, dude, if why are you going to do this? Like, if you're going to do this to me, I'm leaving the book. But, and maybe this is just something I've gotten used to with Valiant, but pretty much at the end of every single arc of a Valiant book, their artists rotate. They sort of have 7 or 8 artists in house, and they all sort of play musical chairs. And I think it's a good approach, and in an odd way, it's that constant rotation that sometimes keeps me really reading Valiant books, because you're learning new artist styles, and it's really cool to see a different person taking on the exact same sets of characters every 3 or 4 issues, and it keeps things fresh, and sometimes I value that more than the idea that on a certain book I'm going to have an artist forever, which is not to knock Greg Capullo. That's not anything negative against him.
Right.
So.
Right. That's interesting. You know, that raises a couple questions. The idea of there being legacy titles, you know, obviously when we're talking about the big two, we're talking about characters that have been around for decades, but also titles that have been around for decades. Something like Detective Comics or Action Comics, although now they're linked with certain characters, those titles are always going to be around, and they're always going to be changing, right? There's always going to be a new creative team every few months, or sometimes more often, right? And I think that's what keeps the book interesting in a way. Like you said, it's a showcase for different talent, but I don't feel sometimes the need to continue on books like that. I'll jump in when there's a creative team that I am familiar with or I'm interested in, and I can jump off when they leave. I don't feel a commitment to the title so much as a commitment to the creative team in cases like that. I'm glad that Greg Pak took over Action Comics, and I was excited to read it because I wasn't reading any Superman books because none of the options seemed very interesting.
Were you going to, just out of curiosity, were you going to read it if Diggle actually ended up sticking around, or was that not enough for you? Remember that whole little debacle where he was actually supposed to jump on, and then he wrote like 2 issues and then left, and it was weird, and no one to this day really knows exactly what went down.
Well, if you're talking about Action Comics, that was a perfect example of me leaving as soon as the creative team was done. As soon as Morrison wrapped up his run on Action, I jumped off. You know what I mean? That was a commitment to Morrison more than the character. So,
sure.
Even though I love Superman, I knew that Morrison leaving was a sign for me to go too, and then I eventually came back to it. The other issue you have, I think, with Big Two books is that they cross over too much for me sometimes, and it can be hard to stick through, for example, Action Comics when it was crossing over with Superman and a couple other titles for the, you know, Doomsday Superman, crossover Wonder Woman, and doomed, all that, you know.
Doomed,
I'm just sticking with the one title out of commitment to the title and the creative team, and a lot of times I have no idea what's going on. But that, you know, that's, again, part habit because it's on my pull list and part because I have a connection to the creative team and it's worth sticking through for me to weather the storm of the crossover. I guess.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, from what I tell, John, you don't really read a lot of, you know, Big Two or superhero books, so that's really not a problem for you. You can read the books you enjoy and not worry about other books interfering too much.
Yeah, actually, I didn't have much to say about the whole idea of creative teams switching back and forth because I read almost... Man, words are hard, let me tell you what. I read almost exclusively Image books, and then also Squirrel Girl to, you know, for the exception that makes the rule. And other than Rat Queens with that whole artist debacle, there isn't really a lot of creative team switching. So that's never something that I've had to consider or think about or even worry about because I just, that's how it's always been, is I know that X and Y will be on this book.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you about, like, when you do dabble in Marvel on occasion, which it does sound like you do, are you intentionally looking for books that don't seem to interact with other books due to events or anything? Is that partially how you pick your ongoing titles? Or?
Yep. Okay. I didn't realize that's I did this I until I picked up the new Thor, where it's old Thor, Odin's son, you know, he can't lift the hammer, so new Thor comes along and grabs it, and she's kicking ass and everything, and then they tied it into Secret Wars, and there was like a cop drama of Thor's. And
say, didn't they just rename it Thor's now?
Yes, they did. It was Thor's plural. And
I love that's
it showed up on my pull list one day, and I didn't know what it was, and I felt vaguely betrayed by my comic shop because I had hoped they'd known me better by then. And that's when I realized that I don't like crossovers. I feel that if I wanted to buy that comic, I would have done so, and I shouldn't feel sort of shoehorned into getting this crossover to get this extra material. And so I said, no, drop that. I don't want it. And so they did. And later on, Thor came back, but I was spitefully not getting it. It's like, no, you burned me once. I'm not going to do this anymore. And so I think, yeah, actually, I do focus or try to focus on issue or comics that I feel will not be involved in crossovers or other events.
Yeah, I think that's a good policy. And I noticed I did that when I was reading more Marvel stuff recently. I was sticking mainly to Daredevil and She-Hulk because I knew they would never cross over with anything else too much. So you save a lot of dollars that way by avoiding crossovers, I think.
Absolutely.
So, speaking of the distinction between the big two, DC and Marvel, and Image, I think this opens up a conversation about their publishing practices and whether or not those practices influence whether you stay in a book or not. I feel that Marvel especially, their constant renumbering and retitling, in the case of Thor's, lends itself to opportunities for people to just drop titles. I know I've done it before, where if a book is suddenly rebooted at number one, I'm like, well, all right, there's my opportunity to drop it off my pull list. You know, I can kind of jump off easily. Is that something that you guys do, or do you just stick with it no matter what? Do you have, you know, like seven different X-Men number ones or whatever? You know, is renumbering or relaunching or rebooting something that would give you an opportunity to drop a title if you were inclined to do so?
That's a good question. And I think being a DC reader like yourself, we haven't had much to do with this whole renumbering thing. We really haven't had much of that.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, Suicide Squad became New Suicide Squad, and yeah, they started the renumbering then. I can't seem to come up with any other instances. Can you? I can't come up with any other books that... Batgirl. Batgirl also renumbered.
Did it renumber or just have a new creative team? I think it was just a different creative team.
I think it renumbered.
Okay. Well,
I feel like, quick, everyone Google it. Just kidding. Except
except us, right?
Except three.
Except the quiet sound of typing.
Yeah, except me Googling. And anyway, long story short, even if it did start renumbering, those are like two examples. And DC really hasn't messed with this whole renumbering thing that much. I think for them... instead of renumbering, they just launch new books, and right. Sometimes they just launch a new book, which is very similar to for example, you had Batman and Robin. Batman and Robin ended, and they kind of relaunched it as Robin, son of Bruce Wayne or Batman? It's Robin, son of Batman. I think it's Robin, son of
Batman. Yeah.
There was another book that was Damian, son of
Bruce Wayne.
Fuck it, whatever. Yeah. Exactly, and so they're not renumbering. But they are basically effectively restarting the book with perhaps a slightly different focus. And I think I like how DC does that because it does sort of make it very clear that the book is changing what it is a little bit. And they are changing the name enough that hopefully your store is not going to automatically jump you onto the new one. Whereas, for example, with Squirrel Girl or something like that, if you read the old one, maybe you don't, as you said, maybe you don't want to read what's being launched now, and there's a good chance your store is probably going to keep you on whatever it is anyway. So
yeah,
I don't deal with renumberings a lot. DC just sort of shuts down titles and shuffles the character or retitles it and switches it over. So it's not as much of an issue for me. More so what I guess, like we talked about earlier, more so what I look at more is just keeping an eye on the horizon in terms of teams.
Right.
Just who's coming or who's going. And DC, I'll give them this. If you just start Googling future issues of a comic, usually DC's result is first, and they'll tell you. You can figure out for the next four or five issues, is a new art going to begin? Is there going to be a new artist at some point? Is there going to be a fill-in artist? They do a really good job of putting that information out there, even if perhaps they don't want you finding it. So I find that if you're willing to put in a little bit of research, you can actually figure out sort of the trajectory of your book. Because I know sometimes people are like, you know, I had no idea this arc was going to go on for eight issues. Mm-hmm. Or who knew this book was going to have fill-in art for three issues in a row. Or that they were going to bring a backup artist on board. Or that it was going to have a fill-in story about a character I don't like. I mean, that's a double-edged sword. We've talked about the advantages of maybe being too or hyper-informed about your books and the advantages of perhaps maybe going in blind a lot of the time and, you know, the natural surprise that comes from that. But I find that being able to really map out where your books are going, really, that really helps me figure out a lot of the time maybe what ongoing and what ongoing books I'm going to keep. Like, when I found out that Riley Rossmo was coming back for Constantine the Hellblazer 6, I was like, that's awesome, I'm sticking this book out. No offense to Vanessa Del Rey, she did a fantastic job, but bringing Rossmo back was a great choice. Do you guys ever do any of this? Do you ever like fall down the rabbit hole, push pins and yarn and start mapping out your book or what? Just me?
It's interesting. Like I said, a lot of it comes down to just habit for me. You know, I put the books on my pull list. They show up in my box at the comic book shop. I'm happy. Sometimes I forget that I'm pulling books, and then I have to, you know, talk to my shop about dropping them. But doing the research, it's alarming how much easier it can be if you do a little bit of research, a little extra work to find out what's going on, you know, and then you're not either caught in the dark by pulling a book that you weren't intending on buying, and also you can jump on titles before they launch and you can kind of be aware of what's going on. That, I think, really helps, especially in the midst of all these renumberings. I remember going to the shop and having all new Hawkeye in my box, even though I didn't want all new Hawkeye. I was just reading the old Hawkeye, you know? Things like that can be confusing and frustrating if you don't do the work, but who's got time for that, Nick? Besides you.
Yeah, well, apparently it's me. Yeah. Yeah.
But again, I think that's interesting because it seems like problems that only people that are invested in DC and Marvel really have to deal with. I mean, right, John, you don't really have to worry about Image books being renumbered or anything like that, so it's pretty easy to keep track of all of it.
I haven't yet. I don't foresee it being a problem. It does seem to be something that's exclusive to the big two, and primarily so Marvel. And yeah, it's something that I think is a kind of a draw. And I jumped into comics right around when Marvel decided to renumber all of their titles, or most of their titles.
Mm-hmm. And so I mean every other week.
Yeah.
Cheap shot. Not even that good of one.
But I found it somewhat useful because I wanted to pick up a number one or a number two rather than a number 176, but it was a new arc. It felt better to me to do that than it would have to have picked up, you know, a new arc, but the number is just astronomically high. But that being said, I can also see how it would get kind of tiresome and sort of alienating to the long-term readers to, oh, well, here's, you know, 1 through 8, and then here's 1 through 8, but it's actually 9 through 16.
Right.
So I can see how that would be a problem, and I'm glad that Image doesn't do that, although it is sort of troubling or difficult, I suppose is a better word, for people who are trying to get into a series, for example, Saga, late. They have to track down, or God forbid, Invincible. You have to track down a veritable library's worth of comics to catch up, or just spend a lot of time on Wikipedia. And if you don't mind, just actually not reading the single issues and just getting the gist of the information, you can jump on it, you know, at any point you want. But if you wanted to get the complete full story, you would have to invest a lot of time and money in tracking down all of the trades and reading all of them so you can get current. But hey, during that time, even more of them came out. So hey, do you have the comic shop poll for you, or do you wait?
Yeah.
So I can see, while I enjoy Image not doing a lot of renumbering, I can see how it's useful for people trying to jump on.
That's a really interesting point. So that's kind of my next question, is this idea of jumping on books. Is it more tempting to jump on with a number one or to jump on in the middle? I feel like you said, a lot of new readers are coming to comics, and the idea of picking up a number one is very appealing. So it's like a fresh start of the series. It's an introduction to a new reader. It doesn't have the sort of daunting, you know, number, like jumping on, say, like Amazing Spider-Man number 430. Like, you know, do I have to read the other ones? You know?
Yeah. Speaking from experience, it takes away, it takes away a lot of stress, and stress is probably a good word for it, because it's not like, oh, I'm buying number 50. What if I like this one? Do I have to buy another 49?
Right.
My favorite part are like the really aggressive editor's notes, where just throughout a whole issue, you'll be like, you remember this from issue 17, right? And then this happened over in the third annual last year. You remember that, right?
Of course.
Wait, you don't? Well, better go buy them.
You know, it's interesting. As far as I know, the history of comics, back in the 60s, when Marvel was sort of really ramping up again with Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and introducing all these new characters, they would introduce a character in an ongoing series. So like Iron Man debuted in Tales of Suspense, but it was Tales of Suspense number like 250 or whatever. And when Iron Man became popular, they continued the numbering of Tales of Suspense. So suddenly Tales of Suspense went from being issue like 340 to Iron Man number 341. The idea was...
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
The idea was that readers would think, oh, this book has been published a long time. It must be good. And I feel like nowadays the opposite is true. Like, I don't want to worry about that. I want to start reading fresh with number one. It's a very interesting marketing technique that I guess they used back then. It's like, well, this book has been around for this many issues. It must be good. I feel like nowadays it's kind of the opposite. It's like, I want a fresh start. I want to jump in right away with number one so I don't have to worry about catching up on anything.
That's a good point. And I was sort of wondering for myself when I was thinking, obviously, about this whole issue, what keeps you reading and ongoing. I was wondering if it bothers you guys when you're reading a book that's been established, it's been around for a while, maybe a couple years, and your book keeps trying to throw on all of these jumping on points. And does it bother you, not being the person who's actually trying to get into the book, but the person who's actually continually reading this book, and it's like, here's another attempt to try to get new readers, and maybe it's elitist and wrong, but a lot of the time I'm just like, you know what, you guys go back and just start with number one. If it's not like unfathomable, maybe it's like 30 issues or something, just go back and quit trying to provide jumping on points to a book that really, for the most part, it's going to be a half-assed attempt at getting new readers. Does it attract you to a book when you know or seemingly think that it's not going to try that stunt?
I don't mind it so much. Oh, go ahead. Sorry,
Paul. Oh, I was just going to say, I don't know if I've seen that too much, but I think it would be somewhat frustrating. So that's all I was going to say.
Yeah.
If it's not done in such a way that they sort of shove the same information down your throat, like, gosh, I don't know, let's take Iron Man for an example. If they keep talking about Iron Man's past every single 10th issue because they just want to get people on and they want to give them that backstory to allow them to get into the series, that's where I'd have a problem with this, is if they waste my time with rehashing the same information for potential new readers. But if they make it like a new arc and like a fresh start on that arc where it doesn't really have to do with the previous stuff, but they're not like, this is Iron Man, this is his whole deal once again.
He likes drinking again.
He'll have a flashback, yeah, about drinking for the fifth time. Yeah. If they didn't do it like that and they did it more of a, you know, hey, this is a place where you could jump on and you wouldn't need a lot of prior information, I wouldn't care so much about that. It would be the part if they started to like shoehorn information, the same information down my throat of, this is his deal, this is what he's all about, just in case you're new. I think that's when I would take issue with it.
Yeah, this came to mind for me because, as I think I've said before, Bloodshot was recently got a huge overhaul when it got turned into Bloodshot Reborn, and Jeff Lemire reinvented the character, and that was maybe about 8 issues ago, and yet I'm already reading in previews, I think, for issue number 10. They're like, this is a great new jumping on point to the series, like, this will be a great spot for new readers, and I'm like, like, there's only 10 issues to read. There's just 10. There's 2 arcs. The first one's $9.99. Like, one of 2 things is happening here. You're either going to attempt to waste some valuable page space trying to recap everything again for a book that just got a huge overhaul 8 issues ago, or you're just telling people, like, I feel like the beginning of a new arc is now instantly synonymous with, this is a great jumping on point. Like, regardless of whether it's true or not, they're like, this is a new arc, so it's a better starting point than, I don't know, halfway through this arc. Doy.
Well, I think
you know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's synonymous now. It's like, this is a new arc, so you should start here. No, you shouldn't.
That's really interesting, and I think it might speak to a larger topic that we might not have time to delve into too much this episode, but that really speaks to the way comic books are consumed as entertainment. I think that in the past, comic books are usually seen as just being more frivolous, and you could just read one on its own, didn't have to worry about buying a series continually so much. So the idea was that every issue could potentially be someone's first issue. So there was a more of an effort to make all of the information you needed available in the comic itself, the individual issue. Nowadays, I think more readers tend to gravitate toward long-running series or mini-series that they're going to buy the whole thing. It's a self-contained story, more or less, rather than just being individual issues, if that makes sense.
And I think in some way, would you argue that writers, in some ways, consciously or not, are writing for the trade now?
more often than not, I see that, and that always kind of bugs me as someone who reads single issues, but there's ways around that. You know, I remember when Geoff Johns was writing Flash, you know, every issue started with the exact same introduction. He did the same thing in Green Lantern. It was a narration of the character introducing themselves to the reader, and it never felt frivolous or unnecessary. It was just part of the flow of the overall individual issue. So there's ways around that, and I think writers could make an effort to remember that each issue could potentially be someone's first issue, but as a whole, I feel like a lot of the industry is just aimed at trade writing and waiting for trades, so that's just the nature of it, it seems.
And that whenever you begin a new arc, your arc has to go long enough to fill a trade. Otherwise, you better cross your fingers and hope that you had an annual come out that year and maybe something else that you can fill the rest of the trade with.
Yeah.
And I think that really brings us back to our topic of, you know, what keeps you reading and ongoing. And I think some people have a preference toward episodic issues and some people have a preference towards longer running, you know, arcs. And and I personally, after having a couple really long ongoing arcs go way too long and just stretch things out way too much, I've begun to sort of have a preference where if I know certain writers or I know certain books are more predisposed to doing much longer arcs, I'll try to avoid those books now. That's just the way it is. I like 4 to 5 issues at most. If you try to go to like 8, like Justice League United went to 8, that's not okay. That's way too much of waiting and hoping for things to improve sometimes.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. This episode was produced by Mike Rappin and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Poldor, Damu the Fudge Monk, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep current with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. If you have a topic you'd like us to talk about, or if you just want to say hi, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. Also, feel free to shoot us a message on Twitter @destroythecyb, follow us on Tumblr @destroythecyborg.tumblr.com, and check out our subreddit @ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
I was actually, Jordan and I were talking about going and seeing that Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Seth Rogen, Anthony Mackie Christmas movie.
What? I haven't heard of that one. You haven't heard about this? No, no.
What is it called? It's another one of those movies named after a Christmas Carol lyric. You know how they do that shit. Yeah. Let's just Google JGL Christmas movie.
I think if anything is a Christmas movie, I end up sort of staying away from it.
Oh, sure.
just because, I don't know, I think I've been soured on that front for so long.
It's called The Night Before.
Okay, okay. What's the, you want to, like, pitch this to me real quick?
Sure. For the last 10 years, blah, 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 lifelong buddies, JGL, Seth Rogen, Anthony Mackie, have gathered on Christmas Eve to celebrate the holidays with a bang. As Isaac prepares, that's Seth Rogen, to become a first-time father, the friends now realize their annual tradition is coming to a sad end. To make it as memorable as possible, they plan a night of debauchery and hilarity by searching for the Nutcracker Ball, the holy grail of the Christmas parties in New York.
Oh my God.
I know.
No.
Reviews. AV Club says, in a lot of ways, this is a more grown-up version of Superbad. Variety says
in that
it's
happening
raucous
to adults. It's happening to grown-ups.
Variety says it's a raucous, drug-filled ode to the seasonal spirit's power to help man-children mature into responsible adults. The New Yorker says Seth Rogen burst with inventive exuberance in this schematic but genial holiday comedy about millennials settling down. So, it's got a 63% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's not bad.
I don't know. I just, like, I'm not sold on the premise.
The trailer was actually really funny, and I think that's probably the biggest thing for me. Do you... Do you want to see this?
I'll look it up later.
Okay. I just know. Really just, like the cast.
I think the
else.
Idea of like, I don't know, goofy Christmas movies, goofy like holiday family movies. Like I think there was a period of time, late 90s, early 2000s, where we were just inundated with these types of movies. And
well, even every year you get one or two. Yeah, there's no
right. But there were like there. I feel like it was at least three every year, and it was, I don't know, series that were based on characters that were not necessarily Christmas movies, but then they would make a Christmas movie involving that character.
Hmm.
I think so many of those came out, and I maybe saw one or two, and they weren't great. And I mean, I guess that was 10 years ago, at minimum. So I don't know how I would approach those now. But I just remember at the time not being really taken with them, and I don't know if it was because I was a little, I don't know, some serious kid or whatever, or if I just had a different taste in comedy. But I just can't really see myself doing that now. I figured I'd record it over here since it was the in-between stuff.
Yeah.
Suddenly John sounds really different.
Yeah. Rotten Tomatoes, general consensus. Night Before provokes enough belly laughs to qualify as a worthwhile addition to the list of Christmas comedies worth revisiting, even if it isn't quite as consistent as the classics.
And, I think belly laughs, great.
I know, what a dumb phrase.
I think the problem with modern comedies is that I don't know, like it's
all
not
have Seth
my,
Rogen.
Well, yeah, that they all have. No, I don't think that's a problem because I think under the right circumstances, I like Seth Rogen.
Get the fuck out of
the
group.
The problem is, my problem is, I don't enjoy a lot of modern mainstream comedy because to some extent, it's a lot of just revamps of like early 2000 fart jokes, and I'm not about that. I think to a certain extent,
not about
they
to
are,
tell you to go to Paul Blart, buddy.
Oh, I know, but I think to a certain extent they are expanding beyond that. But because there was such a long period of time where movies were like that, I am extremely hesitant now to go into that kind of movie. I think I was talked into. I think you talked me into going and seeing 21 Jump Street, and I went in with the lowest expectations, and because of that, I was just blown away by how funny it actually was.
Fuck you, Miles Davis.
Yeah.
have the rest of the other two of you seen that movie? Because
no. I can't
oh my goodness,
I have.
You
21 Jump Street.
No. It's good. It's really really good. It's so funny.
It's not that I don't believe you. No, actually, that's what it is.
That is, don't believe me. Yeah. No, Channing Tatum is fantastic in this movie because he's basically reinforcing or being what everybody already thinks he is. So
a potato?
Yeah.
Potato.
Channing Potatum?
Yeah.
Channing Tater Tots?
Yeah. No, it's... I would definitely... I realize that one is a hard sell to someone who, well, of course, hasn't seen it, but... Which I guess that's kind of a redundant statement. But.
Well, I mean, I don't know how you ended up selling it to me, but I mean, I went and saw it.
I don't. Yeah. No, I mean, and I was totally nervous mostly. that was gonna be crap too. I mean, I didn't. It wasn't like I watched the original show or anything like that. I just the trailer for that movie was just absolutely hilarious, and I still went, even though Jonah Hill is one of those people that can almost instantly. Like any Jonah Hill comedy, it's almost instantly like that's it.
Yep, that's why I didn't go
Thanks
see
for
it.
Making this easy. Thanks for making this real easy.
I mean,
I think you do.
Yeah, but I think there was a point at which because I feel like in 21 Jump Street he plays the straight man almost.
Oh, totally.
And and I think I like that about him because I mean I went and I saw Superbad. And it was that type of humor, but also the fact that he was playing the funny man that I couldn't really, like, I wasn't sold on that premise, I guess.
On account of him not being funny?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe it wasn't that, but it was more so the movie. not having thought about that movie since I saw it and then tried to wipe it from my mind, I haven't really thought about whether it was his acting or the script that I didn't find funny. But I like him playing sort of the straight man in 21 Jump Street because I feel like that was a role that I hadn't seen him in. So, and I think whenever any actor plays a character outside of their, I guess, normal wheelhouse, I'm always a little intrigued and almost always impressed.
Yeah, I agree with that.